pointing at the door, and if either me or him, moving his thumb between Mike and himself, sees you hanging round Miss Abigail again, you're gonna visit the hospital for a long time. Cliff continued chewing his slice of pizza. You understand, pizza face? Mike asked. Cliff swallowed his food and took the pizza in his hand and placed it back on his plate. He grabbed a napkin, and as he wiped the grease from his fingers, he asked the two fellows, You two gentlemen wouldn't by chance be of Italian descent, would you? The two dark-haired men instinctively gave each other a look, then looked back to the blonde guy. Yeah, Pat said. Cliff pointed his outstretched finger back and forth between them. Both of you? Mike puffed up his chest and said, Yeah, we're both Italian, what of it? A grin spread across Cliff's face as he leaned forward and said, Do you know how many Italians I've killed? Pat leaned forward and asked in a whisper, Excuse me? Cliff said, Oh, you didn't hear me. Let me repeat it. Then he asked for a second time, Do you have any idea how many Italians I've killed? Cliff reached into his front jacket pocket as he said, Let me give you an idea. Pat and Mike watched him pull the Medal of Valor out of his pocket and drop it on the table between them. It landed hard on the wooden table with a loud bang. For the day I got that, pointing at the Medal of Valor, I killed at least 7, maybe as many as 9, but at least 7, Cliff continued. And that was just one fucking day. When I was in Sicily, I killed Italians every day. Sitting back in his chair, he said, And I was in Sicily a long, long time. The two Italian gangsters' faces turned red. In fact, Cliff continued, I killed so many Italians. They made me a war hero. Consequently, because I'm a war hero, I got a license to carry this. Cliff removed a snub-nosed .38 from his other jacket pocket and placed it loud on the table next to the Medal of Valor. Pat and Mike jumped in their seats when they saw him take out the pistol and lay it on the table. Cliff leaned forward and whispered across the table to the two torpedoes, You know what? I betcha I could take that pistol there and shoot both of you dead right now in this shitty little pizza parlor, right in front of the owner, the waiters, the customers, and Charlie Chaplin. And you know what? I betcha. I just betcha I'd get away with it, 'cause I'm a war hero. And you two are just degenerate guinea garbage. Mike Zito had had enough, and now it was time for him to do the talking. He pointed an angry finger at the blonde smart aleck. You listen to me, you army faggot. Cliff interrupted him by snatching his snub-nosed .38 off the table and firing one bullet each into the skulls of Pat and Mike. Red blood shot out of the holes he just made in their craniums, spraying across the tabletop, across the front of Cliff's shirt and face, and practically across the room. The female customers screamed as the male customers hit the ground. Both gangsters tipped over out of their chairs, collapsing on the sawdust-covered floor. Once they were on the ground, Cliff shot them twice more for good measure. Later, when the Cleveland Police Department questioned Cliff about the incident, he told them, "Well, they tried to kidnap myself and Miss Pendergast. The fatter one said he intended to shoot me and throw acid in Miss Pendergast's face to teach her a lesson," adding, "I didn't know what to do. I was so scared." Cliff's theory proved to be right. The Cleveland cops knew exactly who Pat Cardella and Mike Zito were. And if a World War II hero wanted to shoot him dead in a pizza parlor, the police would pay for the pizza. Cliff's story didn't even need to be convincing. It just needed to be plausible. And that was how Cliff Booth got away with murder. The first time. Chapter 18. The Name Ain't Jughead. Caleb, Descartes. When Murdoch Lancer mentioned that the name of the ringleader of the land pirates who'd been stealing his cattle was Caleb Descartes, it took all of Johnny's poker-playing skills not to show a reaction on his face. This proud, bitter old bastard, Murdoch Lancer, his father, was desperate. And it was Caleb Descartes who was the cause of his desperation. When Johnny and his half-brother Scott traveled from different locations to their former childhood home, it was to receive the $1,000 their father offered them if they would listen to a proposal. Neither of the men figured they'd be interested in anything the father they hadn't seen since they were children had to propose. Both men were wrong. For about 200 miles, their father, Murdoch Lancer, was the wealthiest man on the American side of the California-Mexico border. He had the biggest ranch, he owned the biggest home, and he had more cattle than any other man in the Monterey Valley. But now this rich, proud man was desperate. And desperation was not an emotion he was accustomed to. It didn't make him look weak. Murdoch Lancer had the strength, the dignity, and the face of a stagecoach relay horse. But it did make him look worried. Things were definitely bad, but the worry he wore on his face was the acknowledgement that they could get far worse. Ever since Caleb Descartes and his gang of rascals had moved into the area of Royo del Oro, they zeroed in on Murdoch's cows to such a degree, it would appear Caleb had a personal vendetta against the man for some past transgression. But actually, nothing could be further from the truth. It was simply that, in a field of poppies, Murdoch Lancer was the tall poppy. And it's the tall poppy that gets cut down to size. It started with the pilfering of a few head every night. In the beginning, Murdoch posted a couple of ranch hands to act as guards, spending the night in bedrolls to discourage overzealous stake lovers. That seemed to work at first. But then the ranch hand, Pedro, was descended upon by 8 of Caleb's brutal boys. They beat poor Pedro to a bloody pulp, then tied him to a tree and horsewhipped him damn near to death. The bastards herded off 20 steers that night and shot 6 more just for spite. The problem with being the biggest landowner in the territory was, unless you maintained a personal army of gun-toting mean motherfuckers, it was damn near impossible to police an assault this aggressive in nature. The nearest law was a federal marshal, over 150 miles away. And the truth of the matter was, protecting the property of rich men drew very little sympathy from law enforcement agents paid $50 a month. Not only was Caleb herding off significant numbers of steers during the night, but he was also openly selling them at cattle pens 60 miles away, Lancer Ranch brand on their hide and all. Then Caleb and his men moved into the town nearest the Lancer Ranch, Royo del Oro. First, they took over the town's saloon, turning its owner, Pepe, into a terrorized servant in his own establishment. The mayor, a man who took his commitment to the civics of his community as a duty, tried to talk to Caleb. He was bullwhipped in the middle of Main Street for his efforts. The land pirates informed the merchants of Royo Del Oro that unless they wanted their little red schoolhouse burned down to the ground and their women molested on a daily basis, when it came to Pepe and his place and Murdoch and his cows, to mind their own fucking beeswax. Then Caleb moved into the presidential suite of the Hotel Lancaster, and it wasn't too long after that the land pirates started a weekly tax collection from all the business owners in the town. Caleb's plan was simple, a slow, steady, but relentlessly constant experiment of seeing how much guff Murdoch and the citizens of Royo Del Oro were willing to swallow. And experiment after experiment proved the community had a seemingly bottomless appetite. Now, Caleb wasn't so drunk with power that he thought this type of terrorism could last indefinitely. At some point, the army would be called in. But they were a 3-day march away. So by the time the Blue Bellies arrived, Caleb and his men would be long gone. Caleb only had one obstacle: Murdoch Lancer's money. When a man of principle battles a scoundrel, the scoundrel always at first has the upper hand. Because there are some things the man of principle won't do, while the scoundrel will do whatever it takes. That is, until the man of principle is pushed past his breaking point and beyond his nature. Most of Greek tragedy, half of all English theater, and 3/4 of American cinema operated from this premise. Other than leave town, the citizens of Royo Del Oro had no recourse. But Murdoch's money offered him options. He could spend it buying scoundrels of his own. And with Caleb's last transgression, the sniper killing of Murdoch's trusted ramrod, George Gomez, he finally pushed the old man over his self-imposed line. The proposal Murdoch Lancer proposed his sons was simple: split his entire empire 3 ways with them. That meant cattle. That meant land holdings. That meant the ranch house. That meant bank accounts. In order to get it, they had to agree to 2 things. Help Murdoch repel Caleb and his killing thieves from the area, and work the ranch and tend to the business of running a cattle empire for 10 years. After 10 years, if they wanted to leave and cash in their shares, they were free to do so. Both young men had been living hand to mouth for the last couple of years. Scott, a riverboat gambler, living from one poker hand to another, and Johnny from selling his gun arm to the highest bidder, keeping one horse length away from a posse. In both cases, the brothers were risking more than they would ever hope to gain. There was no love lost between the brothers and their father, but both men had to consider his offer, because there was no other scenario on God's green earth where either man could make the money Murdoch was offering them, not legally or illegally. Murdoch Lancer wasn't just rich. Murdoch Lancer possessed wealth. Murdoch Lancer didn't just have a lot of land and a successful business. He had an empire. An empire he said he was willing to split 3 ways. As far as Johnny was concerned, there was only one problem. He hated the fucker. This was the same fucker who threw him and his mother out in the rain. The same fucker who turned his mother into a money-grubbing whore. The same fucker who was ultimately responsible for putting her in that hotel room with that other wealthy fucker who slit her throat. Johnny was 12 years old when that fucker stood trial for the killing of his mother and was found not guilty. He was 14 when he killed that fucker. And he spent the next 10 years killing every member of that fucking jury who acquitted that motherfucker. Johnny slit all their throats so they'd know how his mama died. Gurgling blood, unable to speak, dying slowly, terrified as they looked up at their killer. Then Johnny would smile at their agony and tell them, Marta Conchita Luisa Galvedon Lancer says, hola. It took 10 years to kill those 13 people, but finally Marta Galvedon Lancer was avenged. But the last person left, who had yet to pay the final price for his mama's murder, was the man who sent her on her path of degradation, his father, Murdoch Lancer. Still, that was a lot of cows, a lot of land, a lot of ranch, and a lot of money. More than Johnny could make on his own in 10 lifetimes. And all he had to do to get it was keep from killing his old man and from getting killed by a murderous gang of rustlers. But Johnny had a secret. Something neither Murdoch nor Scott nor anybody else at the Lancer Ranch knew. Johnny Madrid and Caleb Descartu were friends. Johnny Madrid rode his horse down Royo del Oro's main drag. When he rode in on the Butterfield Wells Fargo stage 2 days ago, it seemed a town like 100 others he'd seen before. But that was before knowing the narrative that Murdoch told him and his half-brother. Now Johnny saw what separated Royo del Oro from other towns. This town was terrified. When he first arrived, he noticed the town's big saloon, and he noticed the collection of owl hoots collected in front of it. Now, a lot of towns had saloons, with a lot of owl hoots collecting in front of them. But Johnny knew these weren't just any owl hoots. These were some of the men Johnny had been lured into town to shoo off or kill. These men were the men responsible for Murdoch's misery. These were the land pirates that worked for Caleb Descartu. As he rode past the Gilded Lily, he felt their eyes follow him. Out of the corner of his squinty eye, he counted 4 owl hoots. One was a black fella dressed like a bandito. 2 were banditos dressed like banditos. But it was the 4th man that caught Johnny's eye. A big white man older than the rest. While the other 3 adopted the dress of Mexican scum, he wore a tailored western black suit and fancy cowboy boots of black leather. He sported a crisp, big black cowboy hat on his head and a big soup catcher on his upper lip, slathered with a generous application of mustache wax. The big man sat in a rocking chair on the porch of the Gilded Lily, carving a wooden horse figurine with a pocket knife. Tiny flecks of wood collected in a small pile by his shiny boot. Aside from both his age and his dress, he was different from the other 3 owl hoots on the porch. They were henchmen. He was a cowboy of quality. Johnny couldn't place him. But even if he didn't know who he was, he knew what he was. The big man in the black suit, with the black boots and the big mustache, was a big name with a big reputation. These other prairie dogs divvied up slices of pie for the havoc they caused and the ruckus they raised. The big man was paid a sack of gold by Caleb personally before any work was done. In a gangster story, he'd have been known as an out-of-town torpedo. In an earlier chapter of the big man's story, he could have been the hero. And he had been. But on this page, today, he sold his gun arm to the highest bidder. And in this story, that bidder was Caleb Descartu. Johnny climbed down from his horse and tied it to the hitching post located in front of the Hotel Lancaster. The big man in black folded up his pocket knife and put it away in his pocket. Johnny started crossing the main street of Royo del Oro in the direction of the saloon. The big man in black placed the little horse figurine he was carving on a tiny barrel in front of him and rose out of the rocking chair, moving toward the front of the patio. Johnny was 9 steps away from the bottom stair of the 3-stair porch steps that led to the saloon's front porch when he heard the big man in black call out, "That's far enough, Jughead." Johnny stopped walking. "Name's not Jughead," Johnny corrected. "What you doing around here, boy?" the big man asked. "I'm thirsty," Johnny answered, pointing his finger at the establishment. "That's a saloon, ain't it?" The big man in black turned around and glanced up at the big sign that read, "Saloon," hung up over the entrance, then turned back to Johnny and said, "Yeah, that's a saloon. Only you can't come in." "Why?" Johnny asked. "Y'all closed." The big man smiled and patted the grip of his pistol, which rested in the waistband of his trousers right up against his belly. "Oh, no. We're open for business." Johnny, getting the picture, smiled right back and asked, "So it's just me can't come in?" The big man smiled even wider, this time showing teeth, and said, "That's right." Johnny asked, "Why?" The big man in black explained, "Well, you see, we only serve ladies on ladies' night." The other 3 owl hoots on the porch laughed at his little joke. Johnny laughed a little too and said, "That's a good one. I'm gonna have to remember that one." The big man warned, "You take another step near this saloon, you ain't gonna be remembering nothing ever again." Placing his hands on his hips, the gunfighter in black explained to the young man in the sangria red ruffled shirt the immediate future. "Now look at here, Jughead. You're gonna climb back up on that nag you rode in on, and you're gonna hightail your ass out of here. You hear me, boy?" Johnny squinted his eyes and said, "Oh, I hear just fine. But apparently you don't, 'cause I done told you. The name ain't Jughead." That's when Johnny's hand lowered to the pistol that sat in the holster on his hip, and he unhooked the tiny leather loop wrapped around the hammer of his Widowmaker. In response, the big man's hand lowered down his front, where the grip of his smoke wagon rested inside the waistband of his trousers. Then, as the porch, the street, the town, and the state got quiet, while the 2 men twitched into their killing stances, suddenly, the squeaky batwing doors of the saloon were flung open, and out stepped the villain of the piece, Caleb Descartu. The outlaw gang leader was dressed in a brown rawhide jacket, with leather fringe running down the sleeves, and he was eating a fried chicken drumstick. Johnny felt Caleb step out on the porch, but he was committed to his staring contest with the troublemaker, so he didn't raise his eyes to greet his old friend. "Master Gilbert," Caleb said, addressing the big man from behind his back, "don't let me stop you from earning the money I pay you. I know how bored and restless you get when you run out of tamales." Caleb took a big bite out of the chicken leg, and as he chewed the greasy meat, he said with his mouth full, "But if I were you, I'd find out that Jughead's name." Gilbert asked his boss, "Who is he, Caleb?" Caleb leaned in the doorway of the saloon, swallowed the meat in his mouth, and said, "Allow me to introduce the 2 of you." Pointing at the man in black's back with his chicken bone, Caleb said, "This here's Bob Gilbert." "So that's the businessman," Johnny thought. "The businessman? Johnny asked.
That's right, Bob said. Business Bob Gilbert, and who might you be?
Before Johnny could answer, Caleb tore with his teeth another big piece of meat and skin off the chicken bone and said,
That's a fella named Madrid. Johnny Madrid. Who's Johnny Madrid? Bob asked sarcastically, repeating the name in a mocking, ridiculous fashion.
The other three porch owl hoots laughed until Caleb shot them a shut the fuck up when grown folks are talking look. They piped down.
Business Bob was confused, irritated, and beginning to get a little concerned. He was hired by Caleb to shoo off or kill fellas like this Jughead in red, and he was paid handsomely in gold coin to do it. So why all of a sudden is the man who paid him acting all cute? I mean it, Caleb. Who the hell is this joker?
Caleb tossed what was left of the chicken bone into the street between the two men and said to his hired gun,
You're about to find out, businessman.
And with that, Caleb disappeared back behind the batwing doors. Johnny Madrid turned and faced Bob sideways, his showdown stance demonstrating to the businessman that Johnny meant business. Bob Gilbert's throat went dry as Johnny, standing still as a statue, said,
Ready when you are, Gilbert.
Bob's hand inched toward his holster. Johnny blinked. Bob's body jerked left as his hand grabbed the grip of the pistol. Then his body violently jerked right as Johnny's bullet burrowed smack dab into his pumping heart. The pistol he had just cleared tumbled out of his useless fingers, bouncing off the wood porch into the powdery brown dirt. The big man dressed in black teeter-tottered on his black shiny boot heels and fell face forward down the steps into the street, tipping over a pickle barrel, spilling pickles and pickle water into the dirt.
And so ends the impressive career of Business Bob Gilbert, Johnny thought.
The man in the sangria red ruffled shirt standing in the street with pickles by his feet pointed the still smoking barrel of his gun in the direction of the three porch owl hoots, asking them in Spanish, Anybody else? When Johnny entered the saloon, seven of Caleb's other land pirates who were playing poker at tables, smoking cigars, or drinking booze at the bar raised their eyes to see the fella in the red, ruffled shirt who put Bob out of business. No one looked too angry at the turn of events. I guess Bob didn't make it his business to make friends. Then, from way above his head, Johnny Lancer heard shouted out, Johnny Madrid! His eyes rose and he found his old buddy, Caleb De Catu, standing on the second floor landing, leaning against the impressive wood banister, looking down at him with a smile on his hairy face as big and wide as Texas.
How long's it been?
The bad man in brown asked the bad man in red. Johnny didn't have to think. He knew.
Oh, since that time in Juarez. About 3 years ago.
Caleb blew out smoke from the chair root in his mouth and said,
Well, come on in and have a drink.
As Johnny crossed the saloon floor, heading toward the foot of the staircase, he asked, So I don't gotta wait till ladies' night? The two tough guys made their tough guy jokes.
Well, rules were made to be broken.
Ha ha, Johnny thought.
Well, in that case, Johnny offered. Buy a drink, Caleb?
Sure, Johnny.
Caleb said as he slowly descended the staircase. How about some mezcal? Like that time in Juarez.
Johnny let out a soft chuckle as he shook his head at the memory and said,
A lot of people died that day.
Yes, they did, Caleb said as he finished descending the stairs. But we had a good time, didn't we?
Yes, we did, Johnny replied with a conspiratorial smile at the grim but lively memory.
Then gesturing toward the long brown bar across the room, Madrid said, After you, Descartu. As the two men walked in step toward the bar, Caleb called out to the pathetic wreck that owned the establishment.
Pepe, get your behind that bar. I got a guest.
As Johnny crossed the length of the floor, his eyes took in the gilded lily. It was actually an impressive saloon, befitting a town built by cattle money. He also contemplated his next plan of action. Or at least he would have, if he had a plan. Once he learned he'd receive one-third of a fortune for killing an old friend, it just naturally seemed appropriate to reintroduce himself. But to what end, exactly? Well, exactly, he hadn't quite figured out yet. Since he knew Caleb, if he was backing Murdoch's play, it seemed like a smart move to offer Descartu his services. Then he could work from the inside. Well, if that was still the plan, then it was a good one, provided Caleb wasn't privy to the knowledge that Johnny was Murdoch's son. If he was, it would be Johnny's funeral. So if the plan was to stop Caleb and get his father's beef, so far so good. But ever since he was 12 and he broke ground on his mother's grave, Johnny had another plan. Make Murdoch Lancer pay for what he did to him and his mama. And frankly, in that department, Caleb was doing a better job than Johnny ever could. The old man was at the end of his rope. He was desperate. So the real question was, what did Johnny want more? Money? Or blood? His father's ranch? Or his mother's revenge? Security? Or satisfaction? Pepe moved behind the bar and took the two men's orders.
Dos mezcal, Johnny said.
Then the cowboy asked in Spanish, Any food? Pepe answered, Just beans and tortillas. Johnny turned to Caleb. How's the beans?
I've had worse, was his reply.
Johnny turned to Pepe and said in Spanish, Give me a plate of beans.
$1,
was Pepe's hostile reply in English. Johnny turned back toward Caleb and remarked,
$1 for beans is kind of steep, or am I crazy?
Smashing some peanut shells on the bar with his fist, Caleb justified, Hey, Pepe's got a right to make a living, too. He then picked out the peanuts from the pile of smashed shells and popped them in his mouth. Johnny snorted.
What, your boys aren't big spenders?
Mr. Madrid slapped a big coin on the bar. Pepe noisily slid the coin off and into his hand, made a face at Johnny, and fetched the mezcal bottle. He poured it into two clay cups.
A toast,
Caleb declared as he raised his cup in the air. Johnny did the same.
To my wife and all my sweethearts, may they never meet.
Johnny and Caleb clinked clay cups, then tossed the fiery tasting booze down their gullets. Caleb gestured to a lone brown table located toward the back of the saloon.
Señor Madrid, would you care to join me at my table where I entertain my guests?
Johnny did a slight bow and assured him,
I would be delighted, Monsieur Descartu.
Caleb headed toward the table, barking over his shoulder.
Take the bottle with you.
Johnny turned on his heels and snatched the mezcal bottle off the bar. The lead land pirate scraped a wood chair noisily out from under the table and dropped his ass into it. So, Johnny, what brings you to Royo del Oro?
Oh, you know me, Caleb.
he said as he poured both himself and his host another snort of mezcal. Money. Caleb knocked back his fire water and asked, "Who's paying you round here?" Johnny took a sip of his drink and said, "I hope you." Given his guest his full attention, Caleb asked the million-peso question. "And what have you heard about me?" "I heard about the Lancer Ranch," Johnny told him truthfully. "I heard about all the cattle you've appropriated. A lot of land, a lot of cows, a lot of money, no law to speak of, and nothing but an old man and some Mexican ranch hands to shoo you off." Pepe arrived with a big plate of runny beans and a big wooden spoon and placed it in front of Johnny. Caleb poured himself more hooch and asked, "And what, pray tell, business is that of yours?" "Same business as Business Bob's. I want me a job," Johnny said straight, no chaser. Then added, "And seeing as you just had an opening, I'd like to fill it." "Doing what?" the outlaw asked. Johnny took another sip of booze. Then after a small, dramatic pause said, "Killing Murdoch Lancer." That raised his old buddy's bushy eyebrows. Johnny picked up the lime wedge that came with the mezcal and squeezed it over his plate of beans. "You're pushing that old man pretty hard, but that old man's got money. And Lancer's wealth is trouble with a capital T when it comes to you, Caleb, old boy. 'Cause sure as God made little green apples, sooner or later, one of these days, he's gonna hire some guns and push back. And that ain't gonna be his fellas versus your fellas and best fellas win. The name of that game is gonna be Kill Caleb Decatu." That statement caused Caleb to make a face. Johnny picked up a little jug filled with hot sauce and began to sprinkle it over the beans as he continued. "With you dead, all these prairie dogs you got working for you will find some new hole to live in. With you dead, life goes back to the way it was. And when you're Murdoch goddamn Lancer, life's pretty fucking sweet. Yeah," Johnny said as he scooped up some of the beans he'd just prepared in the big wooden spoon. "Murdoch Lancer will pay a pretty penny for that." Johnny put the spoon in his mouth and began to chew. The outlaw narrowed his eyes at him and said, "Maybe he already has." "Maybe," Johnny said with his mouth full. Then he swallowed and said, "But maybe I don't like Lancer. Maybe I don't like his boots." "What's not to like about Murdoch Lancer's boots?" Caleb asked. "How he uses 'em," Johnny replied. "How's he use 'em?" Caleb asked. "To step on people," Johnny answered. Then, pointing his finger across the table at his host, Johnny added, "But you, Caleb, you I like. I'd much rather work for you sticking a weed up that old man's ass than fight against you defending Murdoch Lancer's cows." Taking a dramatic pause, Johnny finished, "Provided you can pay my price." After Johnny said that out loud, he realized, that ain't too far from the truth. Caleb smiled and inquired, "What's your price these days, Johnny?" Johnny stuck the wooden spoon filled with frijoles into his mouth, chewed a bit as he thought, then said with his mouth full, "Well, I think today I'm worth more than you paid Business Bob." Swallowing and grinning at Caleb. Caleb smiled back and ordered, "Get your horse. Put him in our stable." He pointed at one of the doors at the top of the stairs. "You'll sleep here tonight. We hit the Lancer Ranch tomorrow morning. I pay quality men in 14-karat gold coin." "How much?" Johnny asked. Caleb pantomimed a medium sack of gold with his hands. "Oh, about this much."
All the time Johnny had contemplated killing Murdoch Lancer, he never contemplated turning a profit on it. But he sure as hell was contemplating it now. As he smiled and said, "I kill Murdoch Lancer," Johnny pantomimed a larger sack with his hands. "I want this much." Caleb lifted up his clay cup and clinked it against Johnny's cup. Both men brought their fiery liquid up to their lips and drank. But what exactly was he toasting? The execution of a successful undercover operation that placed him on the inside of his father's enemies? Or a newfound collaboration with an old friend against a bitter enemy? What was more important to him? His future or his past? Was he Johnny Lancer or Johnny Madrid? Looked like Johnny had till morning to figure that out. Chapter 19. My friends call me Pussycat. When Cliff noticed the film with Carol Baker playing at the Eros Theater on Beverly Boulevard was rated X, he thought there was a good chance of seeing Carol Baker really fucking somebody. No such luck. Unlike I Am Curious Yellow, where Lena Nyman actually looks like she's fucking on film, the Italian Carol Baker movie was just movie fucking. European movie fucking, which was more lurid and violent, but nobody was actually getting fucked on set. Too bad. But it was a pretty good mystery anyway, and it had a great twist at the end. All in all, not the worst way to spend an afternoon. However, if he knew Carol Baker wasn't really fucking on film, he probably would have seen Ice Station Zebra at the Cinerama Dome. On 93KHJ, the real Don Steele introduces the new song by Los Bravos, The Black is Black Guys, Bring a Little Lovin'. As Cliff speeds down Forest Lawn Drive, makes a right on Hollywood Way, and pulls into the left-hand turn lane, he sits idling, waiting for the light to change to green, at which point he'll negotiate his left-hand turn onto Riverside Drive. Digging the forward momentum of the high-energy Los Bravos tune, Cliff slaps out the song's rhythm against the steering wheel with his fingers. Then he spots her on the corner of Riverside Drive and Hollywood Way, standing in front of a bus stop advertising local Channel 9 newscaster George Putnam, just like she was when he saw her standing in front of the Aquarius Theater. She's hitching a ride. Except now she's alone. Jesus, Cliff thinks, what are the chances of seeing the same hitchhiker 3 times on the same day in 3 different parts of Los Angeles, he thinks. Who knows, with all the kids hitching rides these days, maybe that's not such a big deal. It sure seems like a big deal. But this time, this slinky little sex pot is going in Cliff's direction. In fact, once he receives his green directional arrow, he's going to turn right into her. A quick ride could easily turn into a behind-the-wheel moving blowjob, Cliff's favorite kind. Or at least a 20-minute French kissing session. He rises a little bit in the driver's seat at the anticipation of what this ride could lead to. As Cliff contemplates this thought, the brunette hippie pickle girl spots him idling in the cream-yellow Cadillac. As soon as she sees him, she leaps in the air and waves frantically. Cliff acknowledges her. She sticks out the little fist that's attached to her long arm and gives her protruding thumb a jerk, which indicates, "Give me a lift." He gives her a pointy salute back, which indicates, "I'll give you a lift." In response to his pointy salute, she screeches and does a spastic dance on the street corner. The dance she does could best be described as a combination of a pirouette and jumping jacks. Look at this little grasshopper on the corner, Cliff thinks. Grasshopper is Cliff's name for slinky, sexy, tall girls who are all elbows and kneecaps. He calls them that because when they wrap their long legs and gangly arms around you, it's like fucking a grasshopper. But Cliff thinks the idea of fucking a grasshopper is sort of sexy. So for him, it's a term of endearment. Then, As Cliff sits in Rick's Coupe de Ville, waiting for the light to change, he notices a blue Buick Skylark going in the opposite direction on Hollywood Way, make a right-hand turn at the corner of Riverside Drive, pulling to a stop right next to the brunette hippie pickle girl. Leaning forward in his seat, Cliff says out loud, "What the fuck?" Across traffic, he watches the hippie girl lean down and talk to the driver through the open car door window on the passenger side. After a bit of back and forth between the driver and the hitchhiker, she nods her head yes. She straightens up for a moment, looks across traffic at the blonde guy in the cream-yellow Cadillac, gives him a big shoulder shrug, and dips inside the Skylark. As Pickle Girl's car drives away, Cliff's directional arrow turns green. Cliff negotiates his left-hand turn onto Riverside Drive and falls behind the Buick Skylark. The real Don Steele comes back on the air and reminds listeners, Tina Delgado is alive. Through the Skylark's back window, Cliff can see the outline of both the male driver and the female passenger very clearly. The driver seems to be another hippie type with long, frizzy, curly red hair. Maybe he's that funny-looking guy who plays Bernie on Room 222. He watches the bushy-haired silhouettes talk animatedly with each other. Red-haired, shaggy Skylark guy says something, and Pickle Girl laughs, slapping her bare knee in response. Cliff says to himself, okay, now she's just fucking with me. He yanks the steering wheel to the left, and the Cadillac jerks off of Riverside Drive onto Foreman, and pulls into an open parking space on the curb across from a big beige carpet store. Cliff twists the ignition key, cutting off the engine and the real Don Steele, then gets out of the Cadillac and crosses busy Riverside Drive on foot. Passing the Money Tree Bar and Grill, he walks down the sidewalk heading for the Toluca Lake record store, Hot Wax. The Monkees' catchy hit, The Last Train to Clarksville, hits him right in the ears as soon as he pushes open the record store door. The place smells like most places these days that cater to young people, sort of a combination of incense and BO. Four other customers, all under 25, poke through the store's inventory. A black guy in a dashiki examines Richie Havens' self-titled album. A girl who looks like that chubby flower child singer Melanie, who Cliff's got a crush on, holds Simon and Garfunkel's bookends in her arms. A young guy who looks like he could be the son of somebody Cliff was in the army with riffles through the movie soundtrack section. The fourth patron, like the guy in the Buick Skylark, is another frizzy-haired guy who looks like a cross between Jesus Christ and Arlo Guthrie. He's in discussion with the skinny, shovel-faced 22-year-old male who works at the store about the future of Ringo Starr's career post-Beatles. That Tom Jones song Delilah has been haunting Cliff since he first heard it on the radio 3 weeks ago. He wants to pay attention to the story part of the song, but the only part that he can remember is the chorus, and just catching it when it comes on the radio isn't working out. Naturally, Cliff is partial to songs about guys who kill their women. He walks up to the counter and asks Shovelface where they keep the 8-track tapes. Susan's got the key, Shovelface says. You need to talk to Susan and get her to open the case for you. Apparently, stores thought 8-track tapes were so valuable that they felt the need to keep them under lock and key. You couldn't just thumb through them, choose the one you wanted, and take it up to the counter. You had to get an employee to open a locked case with a key. Then they would stand there and watch over you as you scanned the shelf and made your selection. Then keep an eye on you as you walked to the counter and actually bought the fucking thing. Now, true, it was easier to slip an 8-track of Rubber Soul in your inside pocket than it was an LP. Nevertheless, you would have thought you were trading in diamonds. Also, it's a little odd to assume all your patrons are thieves. Before Cliff can ask, where's Susan, Shovelface points at a golden blonde beach punny type, wearing a buttoned-up Levi's vest and a pair of white skin-tight jeans with a keep-on-truckin' patch on the ass pocket. She's sprucing up the community billboard when Cliff walks up to her and asks,
"You Susan?"
Susan turns to face him and instantly gives Cliff the smile Shovelface has waited 6 months to get. They both have hair so blonde that when their heads are close together, Cliff and Susan resemble two different suns from different galaxies orbiting each other. She confirms to her fellow blonde that indeed she is Susan.
"Can you open the 8-track case for me?"
She involuntarily makes a face that tells Cliff she thinks these 8-track tapes are a pain in the ass, though Cliff doubts whoever owns this record store pays her to spruce up the community billboard. In her toneless voice, which seems to go hand in hand with this type of athletic, sexy, blonde Californian beach girl, Susan tells him,
"Ah, yeah, sure thing. Let me go get the key."
She points over to where the 8-track glass case is.
"Meet me by the 8-track tapes."
Cliff watches her tight white jean-covered ass disappear behind a bead curtain to fetch the key, which, since there's only one, and she's in charge of it, should be in her pocket, not in a desk drawer in some back room behind a bead curtain. He can feel Shovelface's resentment of him as he moves over to the glass case in question. If asked, Cliff would tell Shovelface that he probably had a chance with Susan 4 to 5 months ago. But if he hasn't made his move by now, she probably chalks him up as a dickless wonder, and it doesn't matter how much pizza and beer they have after work. And, in Cliff's opinion, his best bet would be to concentrate on good-looking customers. Cliff scans the 8-track selection through the locked glass, searching for Tom Jones Delilah amongst all the other names. Steppenwolf, The Fifth Dimension, Ian Whitcomb, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Hair, Broadway soundtrack, Zorba the Greek, original soundtrack, Arlo Guthrie's Alice's Restaurant, Mama Cass's solo record, 2 Bill Cosby records, some comedy team named Hudson and Landry that Cliff has never heard of. The Beach Bunny bounces back and unlocks the glass door, sliding it open with a noisy tug. Cliff bends over to better examine the titles. He can feel Susan watching him with her hand on her cocked-out hip. Cliff finds what he's looking for and plucks out Tom Jones' greatest hits. Susan does a slight but audible guffaw and covers her smile with her hand. His eyebrows rise.
"What? Is my choosing Tom Jones funny?"
She nods her golden blonde head as if to say, "Yeah, little." Cliff exits the record store, still a little pissed at Susan, and steps onto the sidewalk, holding a little burgundy bag with the Hot Wax logo on it. He heads for the corner of Riverside Drive and Foreman to cross the street and get back in his vehicle. Then, across traffic, he spots her again. The bushy-haired brunette pickle girl in the cut-off jeans, bare feet, and crocheted halter top. Apparently, waiting for his return by his cream-yellow Cadillac. When she sees him standing on the corner, ready to cross the street and return to his car, she jumps up and waves frantically at him. As Cliff gets the green light and crosses the busy street heading toward both his car and the bushy-haired, barefoot, brunette, hippie pickle girl, he notices something. This girl is younger than she looked through his dirty windshield. How young, he's not sure. But as they converse, he's going to try and examine that. Leaning against his Cadillac, the bushy-haired, barefoot, brunette, hippie pickle girl says,
"Looks like third time's the charm."
"I count you on Riverside Drive and Hollywood Way being our third time," states the blonde dude in the yellow Hawaiian shirt. And it was definitely not charmed.
"Picky, picky, picky,"
bushy-haired, barefoot, brunette, hippie pickle girl teases.
"Okay, Mr. Persnickety, have it your way."
Then she gives a very over-enunciated line reading on, "Fourth time's the charm." How fucking old is she? Cliff thinks. "How are those pickles?" Cliff asks. "Real good. the bushy-haired barefoot brunette hippie pickle girl says. They were the fancy kind. Cliff raises his eyebrows as if to say, good for you.
Give me a ride, she pleads in her cute girl voice, then bites her bottom lip for effect.
What happened to Bernie?
He asks her.
Who?
The guy in the Buick Skylark, he says. She sighs.
Looks like he wasn't going my way.
Which way is your way? Cliff inquires.
She's definitely underage, Cliff has deduced, but how underage?
She's not 14 or 15, so the question is she 16 or 17? Or maybe, who knows, 18?
And then she would officially not be underage, at least as far as the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department is concerned.
I'm going to Chatsworth, she tells him.
That makes him involuntarily giggle. Chatsworth. In her puppet body language, she nods her head yes. With a smirk on his face, Cliff asks her, so you just hitch up and down Riverside Drive till somebody with a lot of free time and a lot of gas agrees to drive you all the way to fucking Chatsworth? She waves away his incredulous reaction.
Shows what you know. Tourists love to drive me. I'm the favorite part of their L.A. vacation.
As she talks with her hands, he notices how big they are.
My God, her fingers are so long, he thinks. They feel pretty good wrapped around my cock and squeezing, with that big giant thumb of hers mashing up the head.
They'll be telling stories about the Hollywood hippie girl.
As she continues to rattle on, he glances down at her feet.
Oh, shit. They're huge, too.
Gave a ride to the movie ranch, too, for the rest of their lives.
Beat one. Beat two. Beat three. Beat four.
Spawn Movie Ranch?
Cliff finally asks.
Deborah Jo's face lights up.
Yeah!
Cliff shifts his weight from his right foot to his left foot and unconsciously shifts the little burgundy hot wax bag with the 8-track tape in it from his left hand to his right hand as he clarifies, so that's where you're going, Spawn Movie Ranch. Again, her bushy head nods in a puppet-like yes accompanied by an uh-huh. Cliff asks, genuinely curious,
why are you going there?
That's where I live, she answers.
Alone? He asks.
No, she assures him. Me and my friends.
What?
He thinks. At first, when she said Spawn Movie Ranch, Cliff just assumed she was George Spawn's hippie granddaughter or his hippie caretaker. But when hippies say friends, they mean other hippies.
So, he clarifies, let me get this straight. You and a bunch of friends like you all live at Spawn Movie Ranch.
Yep.
The stuntman rolls the information around in his brain, then opens the passenger side car door for her. Hop in. I'll give you a lift.
Great, she hollers, and she folds herself up on the passenger side front seat.
Cliff slams the door behind her. He contemplates as he walks around to the driver's side of the Cadillac the information that the bushy-haired brunette, barefoot, hippie pickle girl just gave him. If what she says is true, it does sound like something strange is going on at Spawn Ranch. He's sure ultimately it's probably nothing. Nevertheless, George Spawn is an old man, and it wouldn't hurt to check up on him. All it'll cost him is the drive to Chatsworth. He ain't got anything else better to do this late afternoon. Might as well look in on an old friend. In the meantime, he intends to keep flirting with elbows and kneecaps, and maybe find out more about these friends and where they came from. Soon they're speeding down Riverside Drive. On the radio, the real Don Steele is joking his way through a commercial for Tanya Tanning Butter. Deborah Jo, who gets a lot of rides, immediately starts going into the directions of how to get to Spawn Ranch.
So you want to get on the Hollywood Freeway,
Cliff cuts her off. I know where it is. She leans her fuzzy head back in the seat and gives the blonde dude in the Hawaiian shirt a curious look.
Are you some old cowboy dude who used to make movies at the ranch?
Whoa, Cliff says, with such enthusiasm it surprises Deborah Jo.
What?
She asks. He answers as he maneuvers the Cadillac around traffic.
I'm just surprised what an accurate description of me that was. Some old cowboy dude who used to make movies at Spawn Ranch.
Deborah Jo laughs. So you used to make westerns at the ranch?
He nods his head yes.
Back in the old-timey days? She adds.
Well, if by old-timey days you mean television 8 years ago, yeah, he says.
Deborah Jo puts her huge, dirty feet up on the Cadillac dashboard, pushes her filthy soles into the smooth, cold glass of the windshield, and asks, Were you an actor?
No, he tells her. I'm a stuntman.
Stuntman? She repeats excitedly. That's way better.
Really? He asks. Why is that way better?
Actors are phony, she says with an air of authority. They just say lines that other people write. They pretend to murder people on their stupid TV shows while real people are being murdered every day in Vietnam.
Well, that's one way to think about it, Cliff thinks. She continues.
But stuntmen? You guys are different. You jump off fucking buildings. You set yourselves on fire. You embrace fear.
Then going into the philosophy she learned from Charlie, it's only by embracing fear that one conquers oneself.
To conquer fear is to render one unconquerable, she says with a satisfied smile on her pretty face.
Whatever the fuck that means is what Cliff thinks but doesn't say as he takes the ramp to the northbound Hollywood freeway.
On KHJ's Big 93, the Box Tops' new song, Sweet Cream Lady's Forward March, comes out of the speakers. After he successfully merges into traffic, Cliff decides to ask, What's your name?
My friends call me Pussycat. What's your real name?
You don't want to be my friend?
Of course I want to be your friend.
Then I told you. My friends call me Pussycat.
Fair enough. Pleased to meet you, Pussycat.
Aloha. Did you know aloha means hello and goodbye?
Actually, I did know that. Touching the shoulder of his yellow shirt.
Are you Hawaiian?
No.
So what's your name, Mr. Blonde?
Cliff.
Cliff?
Yeah.
Clifford or just Cliff?
Just Cliff.
Clifton?
Just Cliff.
You don't like Clifton?
It's not my name.
She lowers her legs from the dash and snatches up the little burgundy hot wax bag off the front seat. What'd you get?
Cliff.